On October 10th, Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Commission unanimously approved a 5-year strategic plan that contains 6 values and 5 goals. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR. You can join the conversation by sending your comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. Joining me on the exchange to help us learn more is Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the HECC. Welcome, Ben.
Good morning.
Well, let's begin with a quote from you. You wrote, "Many are questioning whether higher education and training pays off. It does, but it needs to do so better and more equitably. The plan tackles questions of value directly with strategies that bolster relevance, alignment, affordability, and inclusivity, with particular attention to communities that have been historically underserved and marginalized. And it hones in on actionable strategies for our agency and commission, charting out how we will use HECC leadership and authority in this undertaking." That's a bold promise, Ben. How did the commission arrive at this particular focus?
Yeah, thanks. Well, our process began about a year ago when the commission began reviewing its, at the time, existing plan, discussing with each other, you know, where it wanted to go, and then listening to Oregonians statewide, including partners at our colleges and universities, students and other learners, families, you know, community members, community organizations. So through a series of surveys and focus groups and interviews, got a lot of input on the future of Oregon post-secondary education and training and what the state requires, and charted this plan as a result.
So let's talk about the 6 value areas of the plan. You start with collaboration, then creativity and innovation, equity, empathy, integrity, and determination. Tell us about those values.
Yeah, I mean, I think these reflect longstanding commitments on the part of our state commission to work in ways that are meaningfully collaborative and equitable and, you know, responsive to what we're hearing and experiencing, and in ways that are, you know, we enter with humility and empathy and integrity. You know, we're a government agency, right? And I think a lot of people's experience with government, state government, you know, public processes is that they can be, you know, they can be difficult to access or navigate. They can be or seem overly bureaucratic. They can seem, you know, authoritative. And we're, you know, I'm fortunate to work for a commission, for and with a commission that I think has tried very hard and had some success in modeling a more inclusive and equitable and collaborative approach to how we lead in Oregon higher education.
So what was Oregon's 40-40-20 goal?
So back in the late 2000s, so around 2009, the Oregon legislature set a goal in statute that 100% of Oregonians would complete high school or its equivalent. That's the 40 plus 40 plus 20. That 40% of them would go on to earn a bachelor's degree or higher. An additional 40% would earn an associate's degree or some other form of credential beyond high school. Then, of course, that remaining 20% represents the total of 100 completing high school. That goal has been modified over the years. It applies now really in law to the class of high school graduating class of 2025 and beyond, and to young adults. That middle 40 has been broadened to include a variety of you know, career-related certificates and credentials like apprenticeship or licenses, et cetera. It is still in law, and it still is the goal to which most of our efforts as a agency and as a commission are pointed.
Okay, so did we meet those goals?
Well, it's too early to say because, as I noted, it applies specifically to the high school class of 2025 and beyond, and we'll need to give them a few years to see how they do in terms of college or career entry. But we are not on track to meet the goal when we look back 5 or 6 years and look, say, at the high school classes of 2017, 2018, and their post-secondary experiences, as well as high school completion or its equivalent, we see that there are significant gaps, particularly around that middle 40. So we actually come pretty close to meeting that upper or first 40 of Oregonians earning bachelor's degrees anywhere in the country. But we're quite a ways off in terms of Oregonians accessing credentials beyond high school, but not necessarily the bachelor's degree.
When you break that down by demographics, does it break down equitably?
No. There are persistent gaps based on race and ethnicity, as well as geography and income. So much of the work that we've done as a commission and in partnership with other state education agencies and our local and regional partners has been to focus resources and supports on populations that have not historically accessed post-secondary education at those rates or completed post-secondary education at those rates. And the good news is over the last decade, we've seen sizable increases in the proportion of, for example, Latino students accessing post-secondary education and training. We've seen some of the other gaps close somewhat, but we still have significant work to do.
When we talk about increasing those numbers, if we look at the schools that are serving our most vulnerable populations, typically those are our lowest quality schools. How do we fix that?
Well, I'd probably take some issue with the assertion about them being low quality. I think some of the schools that are serving our underrepresented populations, at least in higher education, are among our best and most accessible and inclusive and successful schools at supporting students to get degrees, get credentials, and enter the workforce. But it is true that those schools are often less well resourced than others. And may and present less in the way of certain types of opportunities or programs. So, at the commission at the HECC, which I lead, part of what we've done is really attempt to focus resources on the institutions and the programs that are serving higher numbers of underrepresented populations. So, for example, after the legislature appropriates dollars, a budget, creates a budget for our public universities and separately for our community colleges, our commission determines how to allocate those dollars amongst those public institutions and the formulas upon which those allocations are based. And whereas a decade ago in Oregon, those formulas, those allocations paid no attention to student characteristics, like whether they were low income or whether they were from an underrepresented racial or ethnic group, or whether they were from a rural area or were a veteran student, all characteristics that require more in the way of support to succeed. Today, the commission has determined to really focus funding and weight our funding distributions with reference to those student characteristics. So institutions that enroll greater numbers of, for example, low-income students get greater amounts of state funding.
My guest is Ben Cannon, Executive Director of Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Commission. You can send your questions or comments to jx@jeffnet.org. I should restate my point. You're talking about downstream higher education. I'm thinking about upstream, the K-12 sector, when I think about our most vulnerable populations, low-income communities of color, and the quality of K-12 schools that they're being served with. Isn't that the pathway to get to higher education?
Yeah, it is for many students. Of course, our higher education system works really broadly with adults of all ages. The average age of community college students, for example, is around 25, and many, many participants are quite a bit older than that. So it isn't just or entirely about the K-12 system, but you're right that the quality of a student's K-12 experience, the stability and support that they have within their home and within their community and within their school, most importantly, does bear greatly on their likelihood of enrolling in and succeeding at a college or university or other kind of career training program.
One of your values is empathy. Talk about why.
Yeah. I think it goes back to trying to correct in some ways for the perception and likely the reality that many, government agencies or processes can be cold and seem sort of unsympathetic or disinterested in actual lived human experience. We are committed through the expression of this value in really attempting to understand and appreciate where the people who we purport to serve, including the populations we've just been talking about, are coming from. And to do so requires really attempting to put yourself in the position of someone who may be quite unlike you or have very different experiences than you, and connect with those and use those to help inform decision-making. So the value here, the description here, it speaks to being attuned to our shared humanity and integrating the beliefs and experiences of others in our decision-making. And I mentioned humility earlier. We don't have all the answers. We are, like all people, limited human beings with limited experiences. And so being able to listen to and incorporate and sort of sit in the shoes of others as we make decisions seems very, very important.
Well, you talk about collaboration, and I know a lot of college campuses tend to be isolated and insular. Talk about the importance of collaboration, and what does that look like?
That's a really good question and a really good point. So I'll talk about it in two ways. You mentioned the insularity of some colleges and universities. I think we believe strongly that colleges and universities have had an admirable, if at times misguided, view that they are responsible for students, their students on their own. I think that sense of responsibility for student well-being is important and valuable. But that view that it's sort of on the college or university alone is, I think, misses some opportunities to really work in partnership with communities, including community organizations. Maybe, you mentioned K-12, maybe the schools or community supports that a student had growing up and in their, in their K-12 or home setting. And so we certainly attempt through this plan to encourage and will support efforts by colleges and universities to work with other organizations that are in the game of supporting student well-being, and think that's really meaningful. The other sort of model of collaboration that we have in mind is from college to college, or university to university, or college to university, where I think many colleges and universities have felt like, well, they have to figure it out on their own or do it on their own. And in fact, we have this incredible network of independently, separately governed, but statewide coordinated through the statewide commission, colleges and universities who I think can be sharing a lot more, both in the way of administrative supports, sort of back office functions, as well as potential program options for students, and create a more integrated and seamless system for Oregon learners. So there's quite a bit of emphasis on that within this document.
Well, let's talk about some of the metrics that you're using in the plan.
Yeah, so for each of the goals that you mentioned at the outset, the commission has established some outcomes that it intends to measure as time goes by to see whether we're meeting the goals. So, for example, we will focus on the percentage of Oregonians who get an income boost as a result of their experience in higher education or training. So, are systems moving Oregonians from the lower end to the higher end of the income distribution? We will focus on, when it comes to the alignment of the system, we'll be watching the proportion of credits that a student earns at a community college that are successfully transferred to a public university and applied towards a degree. When it comes to affordability, we'll be evaluating the proportion of learners who continue to have financial need that's unmet by state or institutional grant programs. So we'll be monitoring and tracking the affordability issue.
We were talking about metrics and some of the goals. So let's get into these five goals and the specific outcomes. Let's start with relevance. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, I think it means several things. As I think you noted at the outset, we're pretty concerned with ensuring that Oregonians see value and experience value in their experiences of post-secondary education and training. And one way for an experience to be valuable is for it to be relevant to their future goals, right? So enrolling in a college or university or other training program is unlikely to seem very valuable if it's not connected to one's future goals, including career goals, but not limited to those. So the relevance section of this document speaks to that issue, and it emphasizes work that we intend to do, strategies that we intend to employ in order to ensure that Oregonians' experience with education and training is more relevant to their future goals, including in career.
So you were talking about economic mobility, or you were referring to economic mobility when you refer to the income from moving from the bottom to, you know, up into the mid-tier income levels. How do you measure that? Do you keep track of the students after they graduate?
Yeah, actually, I mean, we're starting to get pretty good with data at the state and knitting together the data that for a long time state agencies have collected from K-12, from higher education, and from employers, namely wage data. And we're beginning to really connect all of that around the learner. And so we can start to examine whether, for example, a student who was in high school in the early 2010s, sort of what their workforce outcomes are or their earnings outcomes are today, and how those might have been impacted by their enrollment at a college or university or training program. So yes, the short answer is we are, we do now have the ability to measure how people's wage trajectories are affected by various types of educational experiences.
Well, technology and innovation ecosystems are changing all the time. And so the jobs of yesterday are not the jobs of tomorrow, and the jobs of 10 years, we don't even know what they're going to be. So how do you prepare students for a future where we can't really grasp what the growth sectors will be?
Yeah, it's a really good point. Well, let me say a couple of things. One is that there are high demand and technical jobs today, many of which are associated with or require some often short-term training that we help to fund and support. And so part of what we do at the commission is monitor and evaluate the job market and the requirements for positions as they grow, as those job demands grow, and work with our colleges and universities and training providers to support the programs that are enrolling students to for those careers. And at the same time, you're right, particularly when you look, or think 3, 5, 10 years out, it is very difficult to know what those technical requirements will be for jobs that may not even yet exist or that we have a hard time even imagining. And that's part of the reason why we continue, particularly when we're working with our colleges and universities on degree granting programs, associate's degree or bachelor's degree granting programs, we continue to believe that a well-rounded education, one that emphasizes critical employability skills such as communication, collaboration, working in teams, problem solving, quantitative reasoning, those fundamental characteristics are also ones that, regardless of the specific technical requirements of the jobs of 5 years from today or 10 years from today, will, we are pretty sure, continue to be required. So I don't think this necessitates a major course correction on the part of our universities as they're preparing bachelor's degree students, even as we continue to be sensitive to the particular needs of today's job market and support programs that are complementing those fundamental skills with more technical training.
Under one of your goals, alignment, you say that the outcome, one of the outcomes, is to increase employment rates for education and training completers. Are you keeping track of who's getting employed and the length of time that they're employed?
Yeah, to some degree, so this plan points to, in part, to work to be done, and there's more we can do with the data that we already collect at the state to understand more clearly which of our completers from which institutions and which types of programs are getting jobs, and in what industries, at what wages, even in what states. There are, again, as I noted, we're actually awash in data at the state and federal level. And so a lot of the challenge here is in making sense of that and organizing it usefully in drawing appropriate conclusions from it. But this is certainly an area that we have the tools to much better understand the relationship between education and employment.
So this is a big one. Affordable access. That's a big goal. And the outcomes are to eliminate unmet financial needs of learners and to close participation, retention, and completion gaps across income levels. How do you tackle that?
Yeah, I mean, through investments in affordability, I think this is both a very ambitious goal and a relatively straightforward one in terms of what it will require to meet. So the strategies here speak to increasing state investment, particularly in lower and middle income students who face serious affordability gaps when they consider going on to college or career training. We measure that. We know what that gap is. We know how it's been changing over time. We see the debt that today's students are very likely incurring. And we recognize that increased public investment is absolutely critical to close those gaps and reduce that level of borrowing and unmet need. The strategies here, though, also speak to the need to ensure that our institutions that are providing education and training are doing everything they can to create a more efficient and lower cost approach, so without sacrificing quality, and in fact, through collaborations that we think can improve access and quality, are providing more affordable access to their programs and services.
Well, is there enough money to make that happen? Is the state and other funders amenable to this goal?
Yeah, ultimately, that's a question of politics and of values and priorities, right? And I'm not the one who gets to decide what on the state budget and its priorities. Clearly, there are states that are similar to Oregon in terms of their economies, their relative wealth, and that do much better than we do in terms of support for post-secondary education. Oregon ranks relatively low among the country, sort of in the bottom third in terms of state or public support for post-secondary education per student or per capita. So we believe that it is possible for our state to invest more, particularly to support affordable access. We look, even northward to the state of Washington, where every low and middle income student right up through the state's median family income, roughly $90,000 for a family of four last time I checked, receives a grant from the state that is the for the lowest income students, the equivalent of their full cost of tuition and fees And for a middle-income student, it's somewhat less than that, but it is still a meaningful grant all the way up through those median-income families. We're not there, right? We would require several hundred million dollars more in state investment. But we think that's not an unrealistic goal, and that's why it's in this plan.
My guest is Ben Cannon, Executive Director of Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Commission. You can send your questions or comments to jx@jeffnut.org. Let's talk about this other goal, belonging. That's the first time I've seen belonging as a goal in any higher education plan. Tell me about it.
Yeah, this reflects sort of years of research and sort of testimonials and understanding, I think growing understanding on the part of higher education leaders and policymakers that no matter what we do in terms of affordability or relevance or alignment, many students will continue to be challenged in completing their education successfully if they don't feel like they belong at the institution where they are enrolled, if they don't feel like that setting is an inclusive one. And so we have work to do as a state to create cultures of inclusivity and belonging at our colleges and universities and training programs, certainly in K-12 and elsewhere, to help our students, help our young and older people feel like they're at home or, you know, something close to it when they set foot on a college campus or in a virtual college classroom, whatever the case may be. So that's what this goal speaks to.
Well, that's an admirable goal because out in the workforce environment, the idea of being valued and feeling a sense of belonging is it's a high priority for individuals. And so there are many companies, corporations out there that are struggling with this. But I wonder what kind of college creates a campus environment where students from all walks of life don't feel like they're welcome. Why is this even a problem?
Well, I think because it requires going beyond, what we've done in the past, right? I think, especially given that colleges and universities historically have been run by, a small subset that disproportionately reflects those who have maybe not experienced poverty or experienced it recently, and perhaps not been a person of color and experienced that or the experience of being from a marginalized community. It requires listening to those students and those experiences in order to understand how to the subtle ways even that the experience needs to change in order to support those students from those groups. So, for example, I spent a couple of days or a day last week in a new building, a new science building at Portland State University that was very intentionally designed to make students from marginalized communities feel like they belong. And it had everything to do, had to do with everything from the types of color choices that were used to the symbols that reflected in part indigenous traditions that were on walls or in ceiling motifs to lighting choices that had to do with safety and student safety, feelings of safety and well-being, much of which was informed by direct student experience and involvement in the building design elements. The HEX role in that, just to speak to sort of how do we influence that, was to prioritize state investment in that particular capital project years ago when we were Portland State University was seeking funding for it. So it's just one of an infinite number of small ways that colleges can take steps with support when they have support and encouragement and when they're listening to community to ensure that their environments are more inclusive and support a greater sense of belonging for students.
Well, I've only got about 30 seconds left. If your plan is successful, how will that success be measured in 5 years?
We would see a greater proportion of Oregonians engaging in education and training after high school, being successful in completing credentials and degrees, and doing so much more equitably without the same types of gaps among our various demographics.
Well, thank you, Ben, for helping us better understand the Commission's new plan.
Thanks a lot.
My guest today was Ben Cannon, Executive Director of Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Commission.